Hey, welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 84, interview with Kelly Baker. Kelly is an independent filmmaker, affectionately known as the Angry Filmmaker, a professional sound designer, and author of several books, including his latest, Road Dog. In this episode, we talk about his upcoming tour around the United States, why he tours, the state of independent film, and the number one lesson he learned in his life. Show notes for this episode are available at gwtw.co/84. Are you passionate and motivated to make the world a better place with your company, product, or culture, and wonder how you're going to market your efforts? Chris Martin Studios is a video production company that answers that question and many others with strategy and creative services for those who dare to build a better world. Head to chrismartinstudios.com to see the latest goods produced for people just like yourself. And while you're there, sign up for my weekly email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. It's a great way to stay connected with Chris Martin Studios and meet awesome people changing the world. All right, you ready for this interview with Kelly? Cue the transitional music. Kelly, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little bit about what you do?
All right. I'm Kelly Baker. I'm known as the Angry Filmmaker, but I'm an independent filmmaker. I'm an author, and I'm a sound designer. Obviously, I make my own films. I've written and directed 3 features, 8 short films, and a bunch of documentaries. I used to direct commercials and those sorts of things. I've written 3 books, and then I still do sound design for people. I was a sound designer on movies like My Own Private Idaho and Good Will Hunting and Finding Forrester and a bunch of claymation specials for CBS, if anybody remembers the California Raisins.
Oh, cool.
So I do a lot of different things, but it's all related to film or writing.
I was recently introduced to your work by a student, Wayne Woods, and he gave me the book Road Dog to read, and I really love that book. I mean, I'm not blowing smoke when I say that, and about it is I feel like I'm sitting in your passenger seat while we're driving down the road, and you're just talking, and I just absolutely love that. And is that a style that you set out to do, or is that just who you are in book form?
I think that's who I am in book form. For the first couple of things I've written now, I'm in the midst of a collection of short stories, and none of them are from my point of view. Hmm. And so I think I'm writing that much more like a regular author, whatever that means. trying to do third, and each story is from a different character's point of view. But I think with my first Angry Filmmaker Survival Guide and Road Dog, I felt it was important to be myself, especially with Road Dog, because it's about me and my dog.
You know, there's so much detail in every story that you tell. And I think I read it somewhere in the Angry Filmmaker Survival Guide, but you're like, write down everything. You don't have a photographic memory. And so how do you remember everything when you're out on the road?
I make notes a lot of times with stuff. And, you know, there's some things that happen to you that are just so, you know, fantastic and so strange that, you know, it's like, how can you forget? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the attitude of the Border Patrol guys down in Texas when they pulled us out of the car. And, you know, they were absolutely certain that they had a big time, you know, drug smuggler. And what they had was a really tired guy and his dog, you know, who'd been on the road for days just trying to get to Austin.
Yeah.
And so even in my tired state, you know, your adrenaline kicks in. And these things that they're telling me, you know, and it's like, wow, and I'm innocent. Can you imagine what would have happened if I had anything in the van?
No kidding, man. It's like the John Oliver the other night did a spot on the Border Patrol and how, you know, it's like, if you're thinking that Border Patrol is this, it's actually more like this. And it's, you know, people sitting around incredibly bored.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, because there's two Border Patrol stories in the book, and the one coming in from Canada for me, you know, I pull up to the border and it's like, great, there's nobody here. I can just zip right through. There's no lines or anything. And then you think, oh no, there's nobody here. There's no lines. They're bored. They're probably going to pull me over because they want something to do. And sure enough, they pulled me over. And, you know, and that was an hour, hour and a half long ordeal.
Mm-hmm. So every fall, you go out on tour, you give workshops, you show your films, you sell your books. Why have you adopted this lifestyle?
I believe as an artist, as a writer, as a filmmaker, that you need to get in touch with your audience. Mm-hmm. You have to go out there and be with your audience, know who they are. Mm-hmm. And when I first started all this stuff, I mean, I had written all these films or made all these films, and film festivals liked them, people liked them. Distributors, the big knock against my work with distributors was there's nobody famous in my films. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, does that prevent them from being good stories and things that, you know, people want to see? And because film festivals absolutely loved my work, and when I would meet people, you know, who would see my work, they really liked it too. And so I just kind of thought, okay, well, let's throw a bunch of DVDs into the car and go out and see if this thing works. And my first tour was just, you know, crazy, and I write a little bit about it. But, you know, I borrowed a pickup truck from a friend of mine. I borrowed a canopy from another friend of mine because the truck didn't have a canopy. And I burned 1,000 DVDs one at a time off my computer.
Wow.
It took 11 days to burn one by one, and I printed them all myself, and, you know, I mean, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I went out and did it, and I came back and went, wow, you know, people liked my work. People bought the DVDs. People wanted to know when I was coming back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for the next 7 years or so, I was out there, you know, twice a year, fall and spring.
Wow. That's really inspiring too, because I think there's a certain mentality in, you know, younger creative people that they look at like the internet as this, you know, playground of getting your work out there. But I love your approach because it, you know, you're seeing real people.
Well, and so many people, because, you know, in the first couple of years, I mean, I'd come to a theater, I'd come to a media arts center, whatever it is, and I'd have an audience of two mm-hmm. or three. Mm-hmm. And I treated them just like I would, you know, if there were 200 people there. I mean, I gave the same workshop, same whatever it is. I mean, I probably worked harder on the smaller workshops than the larger ones, but I told everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think what I'm doing is good, if you like what I'm doing, if you like me, let's stay in touch. And when I come back here next year, bring a bunch of your friends and tell them they're going to have a good time. Mm-hmm. And they would. And so I would go from two or three people in Tulsa to, you know, by the time last time I was in Tulsa, you know, I had 40 or 50, yeah, something like that, you know. And so but like a comedian, like a band, you know, you have to build your audience that way. You can't get frustrated. Well, you can, but it's not going to do you any good. But the other thing is, you mentioned the internet and, you know, younger artists, they just think they can put their stuff up there and they're going to be discovered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't happen. And I think my opinion, and people will, you know, probably disagree with me, but I think that's being lazy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to sit here and do this stuff and just put it up there. And then when I'm not discovered, I'm going to be upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you people don't like me. You people don't know it's good. You know, whatever. When it's, you have to do more than that. And you've always had to do more than that. In Paris, the 1920s, those painters were not sitting around their studios saying, okay, this painting's done. I'm going to hang it on the wall here and wait for the good stuff to happen. You know, they would go out and put together gallery shows. Mm-hmm. They would do things on the streets. They would do whatever it took. I believe that that's what filmmakers and writers need to do now.
I think that's really good insight too, because it's something that I've been seeing and witnessing more and more as I've connected to more fine artists and painters and people that are making more of a physical tactile product, is mm-hmm. that the community that they have built around them and their ability to build those shows and those connections is much stronger than my own abilities, because I was operating internet only for a long time.
Right, right. Well, and you teach as well. And so you see these different people coming in, you know, to take classes from you, to learn from you. And, you know, do most of them have a clue as to really what it's going to take to, you know, to do this, to be successful? And, you know, you have my friend Wayne, you know, as a student, and he's probably older than a lot of your students.
Yes.
He was a successful audio mixer. Mm-hmm. In this town, he worked on a lot of big projects. He and I, you know, known each other for 30 years and worked on a lot of different stuff. But he hit a point, or the place he worked at really hit a point, where they couldn't compete anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why he ended up in your class. He's an incredibly talented audio guy.
Yeah, his first assignment in the class that we're in right now just really blew me away in terms of, you know, not only the sound quality, of course, but just the way that he crafted a story with nothing mm-hmm. but audio.
Oh, that's him. That's him to a T. He's fantastic at that. You know, and that's, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is, you know, as some of us are aging, we're kind of throwaways, which, you know, is bullshit. Mm-hmm. We have so much more. When I was a young filmmaker coming up, I got the chance to work with these old-time sound editors on a couple of really forgettable movies. But they worked for Hitchcock. Mm. They worked on all these different movies that I had seen growing up, or that I had seen when I was in film school. And I would just pester them with questions. You know, how they did this, how would they do that, how did they? And one of them finally looked at me and said, you know, we'll sit here and talk all day because nobody ever asks anymore. You young guys. Well, I was a young guy 40 years ago. You know, and so I find this fascinating that people like to believe that they're doing something new and original when so many things have already been done. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you can talk to these people who have been around, and they can teach you a lot if you're willing to ask and be respectful.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that in the survival guide you had written that really just like made me think twice. But you wrote, mm-hmm. all you have to do is ask. Remember, mm-hmm. don't ask, don't get. And
absolutely.
Why do you think people don't ask?
They're afraid of the word no. Hmm. They are afraid to be rejected, to turn down. And if you look at our society, I mean, throughout the years, the people who have succeeded in all walks of life are those that have been told no. Hmm. They're those who have had failures. You know, a buddy of mine, we refer to each other as we're a couple of old punks, you know, and it's like, you know, we get kicked, we go down, but we get back up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I used to say with a couple of people, you know, I've been kicked worse than this before. You know, you're not that tough. And you have to have some resilience, but I think that, one, parents are afraid to let their children fail. Mm-hmm. Some parents, I wish mine had been afraid, but no, you know, parents are afraid to let their kids fail. And a lot of times parents are afraid to let their kids do things and take chances. And I don't want to get into a discussion of where we talk about, you know, everybody gets a medal for showing up or a ribbon, but I do think that that's part of it. Mm-hmm. When I was teaching, I had a couple of students say, when they finished an assignment, you know, are you going to tell us that we did a good job? And I said, no, I'm going to tell you that you completed the assignment. You know, and it's like, but did we do good? And I said, you know, you're getting B's on the assignment, whatever it was, you know, but you completed the assignment. You did what I expected of you. And so you're not going to tell us we did a great job. And I said, no, if you come into my classroom one day and you have cured cancer, then I'm going to tell you, you've done a great job. If you come into my classroom and give me the assignment, I'm going to say, thank you, you've done the assignment. you know, why do people need to, you know, be patted on the back so much? The reward for all this stuff, I think, is to do good work. Mm-hmm. And if you, you know, do good work, if I do good work, we can look at it and say, you know what, we did pretty good there. Against all odds, we did pretty good. Mm-hmm. And that should be enough for us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's wonderful when other people tell you that they like your work. But I'm fine if other people tell me they hate my work because they have an emotion.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody really hates it, I'm excited. You know, not to give any of your listeners any ideas.
Right.
But, you know, but it's like what I never, ever want to hear is, oh, yeah, that was nice. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it was, because, you know, that means it's forgettable. And we don't want to be forgettable.
How did you learn to take the no's, to build that resilience?
One part of it is growing up. My parents are wonderful people, but I would never, ever call them demonstrative. And, you know, we were given jobs to do. And if you did your jobs, well, you know, you got your allowance and allowance. So you got money when you needed it. We were just never handed anything for nothing. So, you know, we always had to work for it. And I had some teachers who, you know, pretty much didn't like anything that I did. And I always felt like, well, they also don't like me for whatever reason, not knowing if I was being paranoid or what. But, you know, that sort of thing meant to me, I need to try harder. I don't want to try harder to make them like me. I have to do a better job in what I'm doing so that no matter what they think of me, they have to give me a good grade. They have to like the work. And by the time I got to USC's film school, which is where I went, I'm going to tell you, you could not buy a compliment from that faculty. All they did was tear your work apart, and some of them could be really, really rough. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people drop out. And their whole idea was, to survive in this business, you need a thick skin. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start working on that skin right now. And so, you know, I took in all this... And I refused to use the word abuse. I took in all this criticism, and some of it was quite hostile. And I learned something along the way with that, which was, it wasn't personal. Hmm. They did not like something I created. They thought that I was still a nice person, one hopes.
Yeah.
But so I started looking at criticism and that kind of thing as people are critiquing your work. Nobody's coming in and saying, you know, you're kind of an ugly dude, and I don't know why you're making movies. They come in and say, you know, I didn't like your film, and these are the reasons why. Mm-hmm. And if you sit back and listen to those reasons, you might think, oh, okay, the film has a problem, or the book has a problem. Or you can think, you know, they're coming from a totally different point of view than I am. And so is their point of view and their criticism relevant to what I'm trying to do? And if it's not, then discount it. Mm-hmm. And make sure that you don't invite them back to the next screening. Just because there's a couple of people I know in town who are brilliant filmmakers in their own right. But whenever they've critiqued my work, what I get out of the critique is my work is not like theirs. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, you should have done this, you should have done that, you should have done that. And I'll listen to it. And the first few times I was devastated. But then I started thinking about what they'd said. And it's like, well, those are the things that they do. And I'm a different filmmaker and I have a different point of view. So if I do those things they're suggesting, then my stuff's going to be like theirs. I don't want my stuff to be like theirs. I want it to be like mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, with my very first short film, I want to say I think I endured something like 53 rejections from film festivals.
Wow.
I kept all the letters. They're in a box someplace.
Nice.
But 53 rejections. And I don't know if you want me to go into the story or not, but I saw this little ad in this independent filmmaking magazine saying there was a producer in Minneapolis who was looking for short films or films for this national PBS series. And I'd missed the deadline by 2 weeks. But I thought, to hell with this. And I called the guy and I got him on the phone. And I said, I've got this amazing film. You really need to show it. And I was pitching another film that I was working on. And he said, well, he said, you know, you're late, but you can submit it. It sounds interesting. I'm not sure if it's really what we want, but do you have anything else? And I said, well, certainly. I've got this short film that's been, you know, rejected by 53 film festivals. And I didn't put it like that. I said, well, I've got this other short film, and it's about my car. And there's a pause on the phone, and I hear the guy come back and say, you made a film about your car. And I said, yeah, thinking, okay, I've just totally messed up everything here. And he said, I made a film about my car once. Would you send that to me? And I said, you know, sure, if you send me yours. And he said, you know, great. And he sent me the film, which is a very cool film he'd made. But, you know, 3 weeks later, I get a phone call from him saying, congratulations. Your little car movie that has been rejected by 53 film festivals is going to open up our national PBS series. It's the very first film shown on the first night. It's our premiere film. We're putting your film right out front. And I was blown away.
Yeah.
But I believed in the film, which is why I got 53 rejections and called him and ended up, you know, sending it to him. But because I never lost faith in the film, I knew I thought it was a good film. It just needed to find its audience. Mm-hmm. And so if I would have taken all those people's criticism and rejection, you know, I would probably, you know, be working construction or, you know, in a cubicle somewhere or something. That was enough to, you know, to drive me on. And I always tell people that the moral or the joke of the whole story is after the film premiered on PBS, it did really, really, really well. I got 5 or 6 phone calls actually from film festival directors saying, you know, would you submit your film to our festival? And with a couple of them, I got to say, you know what? I already did. And you rejected it. Mm. And I didn't say this in a hostile way. I just said, you know, you rejected my film. And one of them said, well, yeah, but that was before we knew who you were. Mm. And I thought, knew who I was? I'm still the same guy. I'm still, you know, trying to push this stuff out. But because there was a producer in Minneapolis who legitimized me, if you will, and who liked my film and said, this is good enough for our show and it's good enough for the opening slot, suddenly I'm considered a legitimate artist in the eyes of all these film festivals. And, you know, and that always bothered me, that comment, we didn't know who you were.
Yeah, I don't see why that wouldn't bother you, because, you know, it speaks to an arrogance of mind changing and,
yeah,
you know, well, now that someone else has put faith in you or invested in you, it's
right.
A safe bet now.
Right. Right. And, you know, and like I said, I was still the same person. I am still the same person. You know, I still get rejections all the time, my short stories and all this stuff. And you're just going to look at them and say, you know, okay, well, this is their opinion. And where else can I send this now?
What I'm hearing you say is that you have the utmost faith in what you're doing and the stories that you're telling. And regardless of whether you're accepted or rejected, you continually move forward in that.
I think that's true. And I think some of that, you know, comes from growing up, and some of it comes from, you know, never the most popular kid in the school. But I usually had a good story. You know, and I think early on I realized I was a bit of a storyteller, but you have to have faith in yourself. You have to have confidence, and it's not, you know, there's a big difference between faith and confidence than arrogance. Mm. You know, because I truly believe I'm not really arrogant. Mm-hmm. I have confidence in what I'm doing, and I think I'm pretty good. I know there's a lot of people out there who are better. Mm-hmm. But I also know that I can outwork most of them. Mm. You know, what I don't have in talent. And that's what I felt like when I got accepted to USC's film school. I show up there, you know, and I'm some dumb kid from Northwest Portland, you know, Portland, Oregon. And all these people are talking about foreign films and all these amazing directors and all this, and they're all graduate students. I'm an undergraduate. I was an old undergraduate because I didn't go to college right away. But I'm sitting there in this room thinking, I don't belong here. These guys are all so much better than I am. They're so much more talented than I am. And even a couple of the faculty members, I think, thought, yeah, he doesn't belong here. But I just kind of went, you know what? this is my dream. This is where I want to be. And so I might not know as much as these other people. I might not be as talented, but I know hard work. And I know if I work to the best of my ability, I'll be okay. I will get through. I will get by. And I have to say, you know, lucky for me, I've done more than got through and get by. You know, I've had an amazing career run. Yeah. I'm jazzed. I'm so fortunate. I'm so lucky. I'm so blessed. You know, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
But it's all come with a price, and it's all come about because I am totally fearless when it comes to hard work.
That's awesome, man. I think that's such a message that needs to be heard today, in today's creative world, is that, mm-hmm. you know, it's the tools are plentiful, they're so cheap, and yet right. what you can never buy is a work ethic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and master those tools, you know, learn the various things so that you can use them to the best of your ability. Push that envelope. Mm-hmm. And I tell this to people over and over and over again, do not fear failure. Mm-hmm. Failure is a chance to learn, to figure out what you did wrong, and then how can I improve? How can I do this better so that next time there is no fail? Mm-hmm. You know, I've made some films that I will never let anybody see, because I know they're lousy. I was learning. And I learned so much from the films that are bad, that I made that are awful. I learned more from them than I did from the films that I made that are good. Because I got the hang of making the films good. Mm-hmm. But, I was lost and you know, just kind of, I did not know what I was doing in the early days. And so, you know, my early films are not good. And nobody... You know, Picasso did not sit down and paint this amazing thing right off the bat. You know, it took years to perfect his craft. Same thing with, you know, all these writers and painters and filmmakers. If you look at their early works, they're a little rough. You know, you might be able to see potential. Mm-hmm. But nobody, you know, and I think that's something that I don't like with our society. When you have stuff like American Idol or all these other people don't want to pay their dues. Mm-hmm. People want to jump to the front of the line. And the people, a lot of times, who try to jump to the front of the line, their work can't sustain that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you read the chapter in my book, you know, I Blame Your Parents.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes parents have to tell you that what you've done is okay, but it's not great, mm-hmm. and you can do better. You know, my parents were very critical, you know, and I think that helped me. I think that, you know, the 5 years I spent in therapy certainly helped with that. you know, but it's, you know, we all need to fail. And I've had a few students when I've taught on occasion who don't want to commit anything to paper, or to, you know, onto digital media or whatever, because they're afraid it won't be perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tell them, fuck perfect. Give me something. Give me your best shot. Mm. And we can work on it and make it better. We'll never make it perfect. I don't know anybody who, you know, does things that are perfect. All films, all art has flaws. All books, they all have flaws. Mm-hmm.
So as you get older and you keep making work, what does learning and overcoming failure look like now versus when you were younger?
You know, I continue to learn. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to stop. And if I ever feel like, you know, I know it all, mm-hmm. then I'm done. I'm useless, because I have lost, you know, that inner critic. I've lost, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it takes to create. We don't have the capacity to learn everything and to know everything. And so learning to me is a daily thing. You know, I read like crazy. This surprises a lot of people. I don't have a TV.
Oh, wow.
I have not had a TV since I think I'd have to ask my daughter, but I think I pulled it out of here in the mid to late 90s. And she's never missed it. I think to this day, she's 25, and I think she and her fiance don't have a TV either. And, you know, I've got Netflix, I've got internet, obviously, so if I want to watch a film, I can go there. But to me, television was a waste of time, and it took me away from reading. I always have two or three books going at once. You know, I'm writing. I have a 100-pound dog laying next to me. You know, I take him for walks in the evening, or we'll go down, you know, drive down to the coast for the day. Or I try to be active. And part of that, I think, is my age. And I don't know if I should reveal this in an interview like this, but, you know, I've had two open-heart surgeries. And I feel terrific. I'm getting ready to go back out on the road in September. You know, I've taken a 4-year hiatus from touring. But, you know, my chest has been cut open twice. And I'm lucky. You know, I feel great. The dog and I do 3 miles every morning walking. And, you know, and it's all in what you make it. I truly believe that. And as far as failures coming up, oh, I'm sure I'm in for a whole bunch of them. You know, and it's, we talk a little bit about my book, Road Dog. You know, and it's certainly not a failure. It's not selling how I would like it to be. But, you know, I didn't get the gold record in the first, you know, 2 weeks. So, you know, how am I failing there? Yeah. You know, everything we do is work. And so we just have to sit down and do it. And I don't think that's necessarily an age thing. I think the age thing for me, I've got all sorts of friends now who are saying, you know, so what are you going to do when you retire? And I say, you know, I'm not retiring. I mean, if I were to retire, what would I do with all this spare time? Well, I'd write books and I'd make films. Oh, wait a minute. You know, and so, and there's this, and I do think retirement can be a really evil thing. Because all these companies, or the, you know, or whoever you're working for, they take your best years and make you go into a cubicle, make you, you know, do whatever it is. And they burn you out for 40 years, hand you a gold watch, and say, now go out and enjoy life. Do those things you always wanted to do. Well, I'm 60, you know, 5 years old, and I got a bad back from sitting in my cubicle. And what can I do? I can't travel anymore. It's uncomfortable to get on a plane. You know, I think that that's a horrible thing. Now, you know, people disagree with me, but, you know, I've been on my own for 30-some-odd years, 35 years. You know, I have, you know, I barely got health insurance. I have no retirement. I don't have any of those things, you know, that all these people have. I don't have the security that they have. But I've had a blast.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of interesting things and met a lot of interesting people. And it's not going to stop. And, you know, if I'm, you know, sitting in the poorhouse when I'm 85, as long as I can write or read, I'm good. You know, food would be a nice option to have. But too many people get caught up on that whole concept of, I need to work a job that I absolutely hate, but it's going to pay me money so that then I can go out and do the stuff that I love. Can I read you a quote that sits right next to my computer?
Please.
This is, and I found this on Outside Magazine. My daughter looked up who actually really said it, and I can't remember who it was now. But this is a quote I stare at all day, every day, while I'm sitting here working my computer. The quote is, "The most dangerous risk of all, the risk of spending your life not doing what you want on the bet that you can buy yourself the freedom to do it later." And this has been up on my desk for 10 or 12 years.
That's powerful.
We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Hell, we don't know what's going to happen later today, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I can get off the phone with you, go out to check the mail, and get hit by a truck. And what do I have? You know, what have I done with my life? And I can say, you know, I've had a lot of fun. I've done some cool stuff. I've done some, you know, it's when I was undergoing all the heart surgeries and all that other stuff, you know, you have plenty of time to reflect on your imminent demise, should it come to that. And, you know, my whole thing, you know, not once did I think I should have worked harder, or, you know, I wish I had an IRA or a big house. You know, I was able to think back on experiences, and I felt lucky.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. One of the things that I read in the book that you mentioned was in, well, I think it was 86, you interviewed Studs Terkel.
Yes.
And when you were talking about the American Dream chapter, where you started interviewing the people that you were coming across, you know, I really flashed to his book, I believe it was called Work, where he's interviewing, yeah, you know, people throughout the country.
Yeah.
What was it like to interview Studs Terkel?
You know, I thought it was like, it's one of the high points of my life. And it happened when I was 27.
Oh, wow.
So 28. But not to say that I haven't had other high points, because I have. But to sit, because I'd read his work in school, and I'd read his work for pleasure, his books. So I was a huge fan. And the fact that through this friend of mine, I got to meet him and interview him for this film. And he taught me so much about interviewing people. Mm-hmm. And he taught me so much about living. And this was in, like, you know, 3 hours.
Wow.
I mean, he was just one of these guys, very charismatic, very funny, very open, and very caring. You know, and if I would have said to him, you know, during that interview, oh my God, you know, I just realized I don't have enough money to get home, he probably would have opened his wallet and handed me enough. You know, I mean, that's the person he was. And I understand why he could get so many people to open up for him, mm-hmm, you know, and I hope that one day I will, you know, have that skill like he does. But, you know, he was an amazing guy. He was, and I said, if I were to be able to, you know, he's died quite a few years ago now, but, you know, if I were to be able to walk into a room and have, and he's sitting there, you know, it's just like, I could tell him all the great things I learned from him.
And what great things did you learn from him? I mean, how has he shaped your view of listening to stories and seeking to share space with people who may disagree with you?
You always had his undivided attention. Now, you can't tell from our interview, but I'm sitting here, and although one of my computer monitors is on, it's on just its blank screen. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing four things while you and I are talking. I'm listening to what you have to say. I wish we were in the same room, mm-hmm, because then I could really watch what you're saying and how you're saying it. But when I talk to people, I'm not checking my phone. I'm not. You have my 100% undivided attention. Mm-hmm. And if you tell me something, I don't sit here with a list of questions I want to ask you. I have a couple of things on my mind I want to talk to you about. And I will, you know, ask you the first question or ask you something that I'm interested in, but then I'm going to listen to your answer. And my next question or the next part of our conversation is going to flow out of what you just told me. Hmm. I am not going to sit here and cross off questions that I need to know. And there are certain things that I want to know about someone. Like I said, they're not written down. Part of it is to listen to them, hear what they're saying, and ask a question or ask, you know, guide the conversation to where I will get the answers that I want, but I'm going to get more than that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not going to be distracted. Years ago, I did a piece for a high-tech firm. I'm not supposed to say who it was for. It was a ridiculous thing. But anyway, I had to go out and interview. I was in Chicago. I was interviewing physicists. What do I know about physics? Nothing. But I'm interviewing all these physicists about this project, and I met this one guy, and we were at, I think it was Lawrence Livermore, the one in California. And they send out, you know, the PhD who I'm supposed to interview, and I'd read all these notes and all this stuff, so, you know, I knew a little bit, but not, you know, I was an art major, you know? But so this guy comes out, and we're setting up the lights and everything, and I look at him, and he's, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and he's one of the heads of, you know, this particular lab. The dude is about 27, and he's got hair down past his shoulders. And he's wearing, you know, jeans and, you know, a T-shirt of some sort. And so we're killing time talking, and I know he's done these interviews before. And so, and it's like, well, and he's real nice. And I'm thinking, how can I get into this? How can I get him to trust me, to talk to me, to relax? Because I can see, you know, he's kind of looking at his watch and can we hurry up and get this thing done? And so before we started, I said, I got a question for you. I said, do you prefer working, you know, at night when nobody's around or during the day like 9 to 5? And I was like, oh, at night, man. You know, when it's quiet, I really love work at night. And I said, yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I said, you know, if you're blowing shit up in the lab, what kind of music do you like to listen to? And he looked at me and he said, Metallica. Absolutely, Metallica. And I said, really? Have you heard such a... And so we start talking about music and metal stuff and, you know, what he likes and why. I find out he's a mountain biker. He's a this. He's a... By the time we shifted into, you know, interview mode, he was great. Found common stuff that we could talk about. And at the end of the interview, you know, we're breaking everything down and there's all these security people running around. This is all, you know, federal stuff. And he looked at me and he said, can I tell you something? And I said, sure, you know what? And he said, this is the best fucking interview I think I've ever done. Thanks, man. You know, that's a life lesson.
Yeah.
You know, Studs Terkel never backed down from anything. He was blacklisted in the 50s and accused of being a communist. And, you know, as he said, he was never a communist. He just signed a lot of petitions because he felt strongly about things. He was the kind of guy who wouldn't back down. And I'm hoping that, you know, I'm that same kind of person. I'm hoping that if I'm discussing something, especially with somebody whose views, you know, we don't see eye to eye on, I'm not going to back down. I will treat them with respect, but I will continue to respectfully disagree with them. And, you know, they're not going to browbeat me into submission. Better, you know, a lot of people have tried and it just doesn't happen. So, you know, those are the things to me that are life lessons that I got from Studs Terkel, you know, and care about people.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because especially the point about interviews, because one of the things that I'm really passionate about is the art of the interview and really trying to bring people out. And so it was just cool to hear just like the, yeah, you know, focus on the person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a list of questions, but at the same time, I'm not trying to, you know, stick to them. I'm trying to follow that flow because, you know, I'm learning on how to really trust that intuition of a conversation, and it's just really cool to hear, you know, that wisdom from you. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. Now the funny part with that is, you know, I'm trying to finish up a movie that I started shooting 30 years ago that has to do with Studs Terkel and Cabe Boyle and everything, and I've gone back through and I'm hearing all my interviews from 30 to 35 years ago. And I'm listening to the interviews, and obviously I had not caught hold of what Studs was able to teach me at that point, because, you know, I hear myself ask, you know, this person a question, and I hear the answer and I'm like, oh, good, follow. And then I hear my next question and I'm thinking, what room were you in? Did you not just hear what they said? You know, so I'm critiquing the hell out of my younger self, which is it's kind of an interesting thing to do, and it's kind of interesting to be going back this far to finally go back and finish this movie. But every now and again I look at it and say, wow, I've really come a long way, haven't I?
What a powerful statement.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now you're making me think about it. So it's all good.
One of the parts of your book that really fascinated me was you mentioned what you play when you're almost home at the end of a tour. And that really got me thinking about just traditions and rituals. And because when my wife and I go on a road trip, we have that album that we listen to when we're starting off a trip. So we love the movie A Mighty Wind by Christopher Guest. And we love the soundtrack to it because it's just it's good old folk music. And
right. Well, it's a little twisted, but yeah,
it is. Yeah. But that's one of our rituals every time we go on a road trip. And so when you're out on the road, you know, do you ever come across other people's traditions and rituals that really make you think about your own life and what you can bring into your own life?
What a good question. you know, I when I meet people, and I guess I'm not sure if I think about it as traditions as much as, you know, when I see how some people live, how some people react, you know, I can look at some of those things and say, gosh, I wish I was a little bit more like that. Mm. And then, you know, think to myself, well, you can be if you choose to. And so, you know, because I'm all about choice. I mean, we make choices every day, every hour, you know, every few minutes. And so, you know, I'm not coming up with any rituals, as it were. Mm-hmm. But I know that I have been affected by some of the, you know, people that I know out on the road that I've met and, you know, continue to stay in touch with. And it does, a lot of times it does make you look at your own life. And, you know, we all have an exaggerated sense, I think, of ourselves. Sometimes we're daring, we're this, we would do. And I have a friend in West Virginia. And the guy is, he's received two or three Fulbrights.
Wow.
He teaches filmmaking, and he's climbed mountains, and he's a professional wrestler, and he's ridden bulls in the rodeo. Now, this guy is, he's not the same age, so he's 60, 61, and he's done a lot of this stuff in the last 10 or 15 years.
Wow.
And he is 5'8", maybe, balding. 140 pounds, maybe. He's the most unmacho guy you're ever going to meet. But he grew up in a coal mining town. And he said, you know, you look around and you see the people that you grow up with, and, you know, most people, their future was down in the mines. Mm-hmm. And he said, and I couldn't do that. But I also, you know, went out and, you know, there's things that interest me, because he apparently had wanted to ride bulls since he was, like, you know, a kid. And so in his 50s, he learns how to do it and spends an entire season in all these tiny little rodeos, but riding a bull. And he said, I just want to get through one season. Now, he's 25 years older than most of the guys that are out there riding these things. And like I said, there was never a sense of macho, I can do this. And so it's a sense of interest. Mm. I wish to try this. So why not do it? And if I'm going to do it, give it a good chunk of time here to make sure I'm not going to just do it once and say, okay, that's too hard or that's too bad. You know, I'm not sure if he ever stayed on the full 8 seconds without the whole thing. But that didn't mean he didn't try until the very end. And I look at him and I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I want to do, but, you know, maybe it's now is not the time. Maybe not. Well, screw it. It's always the time. Now, I haven't ridden bulls, which has never been, you know, well, you know, but I mean, so I think that from the people that I meet on the road, the people I stay in touch with, I look and see things that they do in their lives. And I see, you know, sometimes you see their fears or, you know, the things that they're really excited about. And you just kind of, you bring it all inside. And I know that Danny has definitely, and another friend of mine, John, you know, they've pushed me to do some things that I had wanted to do but ordinarily wouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm the richer one for it, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
You know, I mean, because what holds us back so often is fear. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid to look stupid. I mean, you know, I mean, it's okay to fear I might die doing this, and then maybe don't do that. But, you know, but I mean, it's like I'm afraid to do something. I'm afraid to, you know, and it's you find out that all that fear, the part that's so scary, is really it's in your head.
Mm-hmm. So if you were to sum up the experiences on the road, if you were to sum up what you've learned over the years, what would the one lesson be?
Part of me says, always be yourself and don't let anybody talk you out of that. Mm. We live in a society and we surround ourselves with people who, no matter what they see, they don't want you necessarily to succeed or succeed, you know, better than they are, far than they have. And they don't want you to be different. They don't want you to change. They don't want you to maybe go someplace where they can't follow. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, you know, and seen people say, you know, I want to do such and such. You know, I want to write this great song. It's like, well, you know, you're not REM. It's no way it's going to happen. You know, you are not Bill Gates. There's no way you're going to. But did they say that same thing to Bill Gates before he, you know, did those things? And so, you know, be yourself. Go after, you know, what it is you want. And don't let people talk you out of it, because people want to talk you out of it. And I don't know why that is. Mm-hmm. But surround yourself with people who encourage you. Surround yourself with people who, you know, push for the best for you and try to help you bring out the best in yourself. And you'll do the same thing with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm getting ready to go back out on the road again. And this is the first road trip in quite a while. And there's a bunch of people telling me, you know, well, you probably shouldn't do it because of your health, because of this, because of that. And it's like, well, those were the same people who were telling me I shouldn't have done it that first time. Because there was no guarantees, and it's scary, and, you know, and I get this all the time. I could not sleep in a different bed all every night. You know, I always have to be in my own bed. And it's like, really? Think about what you're missing. Yeah. You know, I wake up in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I wake up in, you know, New Orleans, Nashville. I mean, I wake up on all these different things, and a new day has started. A new adventure has become. Every day is an adventure, and I think you need to treat it like that. I think that's, you know, more than one little summing up. I think I've just gone off the deep end here.
No, it's great.
Look at every day as an adventure and enjoy it. You know, as a buddy of mine who's also been through surgeries like I have, you know, we have this, when things are really tough, we look at each other, and, you know, and we'll say, you know, there are no bad days above ground. And I think that that's really important to keep in mind. You know, something can fail. The car can break. You know, your partner, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, you know, they can be mad at you. They can be, you know, whatever it is. But you're breathing. You're moving. Mm-hmm. Take it. Don't take all that stuff so seriously. You get an ulcer. You get health problems. It'll all work out. And I think, you know, that's really what I try to take with me every day, is I have these things that I look at, you know, that I want to do in the future. And there's a lot of stuff I certainly like to forget about in my past, although, I mind the past all the time for my work. Yeah. But the key is to be present every day and to do the things that you like to do. You're always going to do stuff that you don't want to do. Or don't, you know, but you get through that and you just smile. Which has got to be a weird thing coming from a guy known as the angry filmmaker, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, on a side note, I absolutely love your angry filmmaker logo. I think that's just pure genius.
I have to give a shout out to Jeff Pollard at Pollard Design. Jeff and I have been friends for years and years. He came up with that design. And, you know, and it became this whole thing where I saw that design and the first thing I thought of was, it's perfect. Do I have the guts to use that as my design, have that as my logo? And, you know, now it's on t-shirts. It's all over the place. So I guess I did.
Yeah. You're absolutely 100% living your authenticity and being who you are. That's awesome.
Well, and if people don't like my logo, they're probably not people that I'm going to want to work with anyway or associate with. You know, it kind of weeds out quite a few people. You know, but that's okay.
Yeah.
And if people don't like the logo, I don't have a problem with that. I get it. You know, everybody has their own beliefs and their own stuff. And far be it from me to tell anybody, you know, differently.
So where can people go to see your logo, learn more about what you do, and even support your upcoming tour?
My website is angryfilmmaker.com. That's angryfilmmaker.com, angryfilmmaker.com. And up on the website right now, I'm doing an Indiegogo campaign for I'm taking my book Road Dog out on the road to tour around the country and, you know, do readings and book signings, because I realized something, which is you cannot write a book about spending 7 years on the road with your dog and then not go out on the road and promote it. So I'm going to be out on the road for about 7 weeks with my dog, Mickey, and, you know, hitting a lot of different places. So there's a link on my website. You can go to Indiegogo and look up the Road Dog Fall Tour. And if you want to donate, that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing, because this stuff, the tours are expensive. Mm-hmm. To do this. But yes, so angryfilmmaker.com. And I tell people, if they have a question that they really, you know, want to ask me, my email is bothermeangryfilmmaker.com. And if it's something, you know, don't waste my time. But if somebody has a question about something and they think I might have the answer, you know, I will answer emails when possible. I'm kind of busy and kind of crazy. But, you know, I would, when I was younger, I wrote to people to ask them questions. And a lot of them returned the letter. And so I try to do that a little bit when I'm able to as well.
Awesome. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for just your time and your attentiveness and just you. I am fundamentally a different person because of the work that you've written for people, and I really mean that. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad we're not in the same room, because I am just like bright red or something right now. I mean, this is, thank you. I mean, thank you so much. It's always humbling to hear somebody say that they were affected by your work, and you know, thank you so much. I don't know what else to say, but I'm glad you got something out of it. I hope people get something out of this interview.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much to Kelly for sharing a glimpse into his life and giving us a few thoughts on a wide range of topics. Don't forget to visit angryfilmmaker.com to support his upcoming tour and purchase Road Dog. It really is a great read. And thank you for taking the time to listen to Getting Work to Work. It means a lot to me that you're here. Would you be willing to share this podcast with your friends and other creative professionals and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co, where they can subscribe to Getting Work to Work, sign up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter, and find the various social media links should they want to be social with me. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice, or you just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.